Now back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Here we go, 5 o'clock hour. We'll get to a deep dive on what happened this last week, what the rest of the season looks like for the Raiders, as Jesse Merrick from Silver and Black Sports Network is going to join us after 5:30. Adam Candy is the company today. It's Cofield. You just sent me a follow-up story. This just came out about 25 minutes ago. We were just talking about Lane Kiffin and all the drama around this whole thing and Lane's game of trying to play this whole deal where, hey, I want to stay at Ole Miss coaching through the end of the season, but also take over at LSU. And there's no way the Ole Miss people were going to allow that to happen. You sent me a tweet from, is this an offensive lineman on Ole Miss? Yeah.
Is in fact their starting center.
There you go.
Their starting center who took Lane's letter that he put out saying, you know, I wanted to be there. And the team asked me to keep coaching. He's referring to the players. The players asked me to keep coaching. And he quote tweeted it to Bryson Sanders and said, quote, despite the team asking me to keep coaching, end quote, coaching, end quote. He said, I think everyone that was in that room would disagree.
Yeah, I like it.
That's not surprising.
Exactly. The moment that that others stop thinking players are stupid is going to be a glorious moment, because they're not, unless you went to Penn State and you were backing Joe Paterno through all that stuff and you're a moron, because you know what Joe did, you know what Sandusky did. But players know what's going on. They also, when someone shows that they have a lack of loyalty, you do not want to be led by them. You're ready to move on, and you're ready to, if the coaches who want to stick around, then you're going to play for them. Now, that said, I guess that's the intriguing thing. When Ole Miss is allowed into these playoffs, I have no idea how to handicap the game. Is it going to be a, let's go, guys, fight the power and screw over Lane Kiffin and rally around him? Or is there going to be a sense of, like, we got abandoned, we've got no shot?
Well, I think that's exactly why Ole Miss didn't play the interim game, right? They went in and took Pete Golding, the DC, and said, you're the permanent head coach. Like, they decided, we are not losing the momentum of this year. We are taking a guy who has been part of this whole thing, and we are making him the leader, kind of the Marcus Freeman Notre Dame playbook that they're using down there at Ole Miss.
So I wanted to get to a little UNLV here. I think Candy cut out there for a second. We get our is he still with us? Candy, you good to go? Yep, told you. We get the 5 o'clock bump on the internets. News out today, some positive stuff for UNLV with the Mountain West Conference. First of all, Anthony Calandria, Candy's there. Adam?
Hello.
Yeah. You were cut off.
I you know what? I'm largely inappropriate. That's fine.
I moved on to UNLV and what
you moved on.
I know. I apologize.
Yeah, I understand why.
Yes. All Mountain West Conference teams came out today. Player of the year offensively is Anthony Calandria, which I don't think we've given enough credit to what the players on UNLV have done and what the coaching staff has done. Calandria was known as a talented guy at Virginia, but it wasn't meshing with that coaching staff. And last year he got pulled from the starting job about 2/3 through the season. His season included 13 touchdowns, 11 interceptions. You know, reading a lot of the Cavalier fans' reactions, some of them were disappointed. Others were like, good riddance, enough of this guy. He's a turnover machine. But some of them could see the potential. And it sounds like Calandria was one of the first guys targeted to play that position for Dan Mullen. And we know Dan Mullen is a historically good quarterback guru. I think that the combination of Mullen and him helping to turn around Calandria, but Calandria also taking all the advice and launching into another stratosphere with 30 total touchdowns between passes and rushing, is one of the really cool stories. And another reason why, you know what, and I will always stand by, the transfer portal 99% of the time is a good thing. Sometimes it just ain't working out for certain kids and coaches don't want them there. Move on, and maybe you can get resurrected. It can be a reclamation project, and Calandria has turned out to be a really cool story.
No, without question. And he deserves the award. The UNLV offense was outstanding, leading the Mountain West in points this year. I've argued to you before that Barry Odom is the second most consequential coach in the history of the university behind Jerry Tarkanian, you could make a fair case that Dan Mullen continuing that deserves to be around that discussion as well, because you cannot overemphasize, if you have any history around this city, you cannot overemphasize enough the idea of UNLV being in a third consecutive Mountain West football championship. It is the sort of thing that was a pipe dream for decades and now is reality.
It's crazy. Yeah, I've seen Boise media people talking about just how inept UNLV has been against Boise over the years. I mentioned it the other day. If you go back, you know, whatever, 4, 6, 8, 10 years ago, the hope when comparing UNLV to Boise was just be able to compete, try to win a game at home every once in a while against them, compete within 14 points. Now, part of that discussion also, I know what I was saying, is I don't see all the limitations that UNLV has in football. I think some of them were self-imposed limitations. They fixed a lot of those things with leadership and driving more money into the program. But I know I always said there is no reason at a minimum that UNLV can't be a factory for offense. Come to Vegas, play in a fun offense, be high scoring, and compete that way. And that's, you know, Odom was one style. Mullen is a different style. They are a high scoring team. And as long as he's around here, if they can keep it going after this, this could be a place where wide receivers and quarterbacks want to play. They've always had good running backs. Amazingly, through all the, you know, all the rough times of the last 10 years, they've always had a pretty good lead running back, but now they've got this group with a really good starting quarterback and their receiving core. Like, I don't think people realize how deep their receiving core is.
I think, yeah, you look at the history of the program and could they have gotten here sooner? What you have to go back to see is, okay, so you had the John Robinson years way back at this point, where they started to show some signs of competence, and then things went really, really badly for a long time. And then you had Tony Sanchez and the Fertitta money show up to help build the facility and get the UNLV buildings looking the way they needed to. Then you had Allegiant Stadium come around to give them a real place to play that is not in a parking lot out in the desert. And you were right where you needed to be. You had all the things finally in place when the portal / NIL era popped, right? If UNLV were still playing out at Sam Boyd and didn't have the brand new training facility, which I guess isn't even brand new anymore, then they wouldn't have been positioned to do what they did now, but they did. And here we are. And it's an unbelievable spot for UNLV to be in. And even if UNLV wins this Mountain West championship game and doesn't get into the college football playoff, just take a moment, take a beat, and think about what it means for this university to be the best in the conference in football. I have been around this city most of my life. It has not even been something that you could dream on. I got here in 1989. They lost 69-0 to Houston and Andre Ware in his Heisman season, and it's been the benchmark for everything in terms of how I look at this program. So I think it's amazing.
And outside the market, of course, this is the way fans are. Now there's more anonymity than ever, so people love to talk trash. There's been this notion that, well, congrats, good luck holding on to Dan Mullen. I will never say never. Something could come up here in the next 5 days where he changes his mind. One of the narratives that has been pushed is that Memphis would love to have him. South Florida and Tulane jobs are open. I think their fans believe that all three of those schools have more money and more support than UNLV. I think Memphis might have more support. I know South Florida was talking some big things with funding, NIL. I don't believe that Dan Mullen would go and make a lateral move. I think when he makes his next move, it's going to be back into the Power Four. There is one wild card, though. And this is why you, until it's done and they find someone, what is going on at Penn State, as I mentioned before the break, is very TKM, you know, UNLV-like with Dave Rice. If you fire James Franklin before the end of the season, if you don't have your coach cinched up, locked up, ready to publicly announce, like the second the season ends, you have botched the entire thing. But I think they misread the situation with Franklin and the agent and Sexton. He's the agent. And how much they could be kind of, you know, shivved without people seeing behind the scenes. And now freaking Penn State is sitting here. Tomorrow is signing day. one of the great jobs in college football. They don't have a coach, and now they just made a run. Again, this is very UNLV-like, right? We can name all the guys who were considered. I mean, they thought that what's his name? The little guy at UCLA, Mick Cronin was taking the job, but he fibbed on his way out of town and then basically never even called to say he didn't want the job. Penn State just made one of those UNLV-like moves back in the day by making a run at Kalani Sitake and challenging the Mormon Church over money. Like, you have no idea what the hell's going on, Penn State. So I don't know what they're going to do. So they're the wild card. What if they're like, Dan Mullen, you know, $13 million a year with a $75 million buyout. At that point, his family, and he's got to go, okay, what are we supposed to do here? We're just going to pass on this?
Okay, so if that happens, then what does that say about the UNLV job, right? That UNLV is a springboard to Penn State for someone to be able to move up. Look, if you're going to talk that kind of trash about UNLV, about holding on to Dan Mullen, you're living in the past because Barry Odom already left. Yeah. And Dan Mullen showed up. A guy who coached in the SEC at multiple stops looked at the UNLV job and said, no, this isn't career suicide. This is not a place I go just to get a paycheck. Like, he showed up, and the team is back in the Mountain West Championship game. So that's not the issue. But if you're Penn State, if you are blue blood Penn State, how did you misread whether Matt Rhule wanted to come be your coach?
Your guy.
Because that's how they screwed this up.
Yep.
The whole thing was set up for Penn State guy Matt Rhule to come home from Nebraska, and then Nebraska got its Tom Osborne on and said, no, we'll pay him. He'll stay. And it's like there was no plan B anywhere in Happy Valley. And if plan B was trying to pry away Kalani Sitake when BYU is about to go into the playoff, then that was misguided.
On the way back, let's get to jobs in the NFL and a little bit of week 14. Let's find out what's going on with Candy's New York Giants and what their future holds. Probably not
Probably not
Mike Kafka.
Now back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
There, you hear the update there from Doug Douglas. UNLV with lots of honors with the Mountain West Conference. Although only two on the first team, which, Candy, you've been around a long time. You know how political these things get, where I don't necessarily know that the people vote on the best players overall. They also look at results, and these become sort of MVP awards, making the team. It is kind of interesting that UNLV only had two on the first team. That's combined offense and defense, and yet I don't really have that much of a problem. I think there might have been a third person who should have made it, but it's sort of the way UNLV is built that they rotate so many players, kind of like Odom's teams did, which is why I think it's been a big part of the success for UNLV. They don't rely on both sides of the ball on like 15 total guys. They rotate a lot of people. So as an example, wide receivers are not going to put up 78, well, Ricky White did. But this year's crew was not going to put up with Dan Mullen's offense. It was not going to have a receiver who was going to go 77 for 1,300 yards.
No, and I think you bring up the good point to say you're okay with it, right?
Yeah.
And it's very, and if you're talking about we're going to reward teams in individual awards, well, then especially defensively, it's really hard for a UNLV team that gave up the third most points in the conference mm-hmm. to be able to make that case.
So why don't I'm going to ask a very rhetorical question. I don't even know if rhetorical is the right term, but why don't we act like a bunch of babies here in the media and stomp and complain? Because I do feel like around the Mountain West Conference, there's other media groups who would be like, you know, the team went 9-3. How can they only have three guys? Like, because in the case of UNLV, they have a lot of good players. I don't think they had some of the best players in the Mountain West Conference outside of Jet Thomas and Calandry. That's just the way, like, are we supposed to be like such hometown guys? Like, hey, let me push up, you know, a bunch of defensive players. And they have good defensive players, but they also had, like you said, they had results where for a while they were allowing 35 points a game.
Man, Steve Cofield, the guy who cannot stand the Air Force media, calling him out live on air right here. Cannot stand Air Force. He thinks those Colorado State beat reporters are full of it. You don't want to hear it anymore.
You know who I'm talking about. There's
I know exactly well, who you're talking about.
There's one main football market, but there's another. There's a basketball market that is, I think, getting good at football, where it's just it's incessant with the hometown cheerleading. And it's Boise and San Diego. I'm not going to leave it hanging out there and subtweet on the air. The cheerleading for their beats, it's just stupid. Like, I'm going over to UNLV right now after the show to go do some interviews. And I don't think I'm going to get accosted by Dan Mullen or some of the players and be like, who'd you vote for? Did you vote for enough of us? What the hell? Like, why didn't we get? Like, they're adults. Okay? I don't feel the need to freaking politic all the time for UNLV.
What does it matter in the end? It's not like the NIL doesn't. Deals have award clauses in them. It's not, you know.
Well, here's a great reward. Because I brought it up in the preseason. I think they only had 3 All-Mountain West Conference first-teamers in the preseason. Boise had 8. Clearly, UNLV had a lot of good players because, you know, they wound up tying with Boise and San Diego State and New Mexico at 6-2. So they had players. They didn't have recognizable players because voters looked and they're like, wait, they have like 5 returning starters? Well, who the hell am I going to vote for? I'm going to take a guess on Reed Williams, who was second team. By the way, I probably am the only person who works in the conference, and I have more intimate knowledge of UNLV than anyone else, but I did say that Reed Williams, I thought, would be an All-Mountain West Conference player. He's second team. So,
I don't mind a little pat on the back to yourself there. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, I recommended another person, a defensive player, who was he was good at times for the Rebels. But he was in a rotation, so, and there were times he didn't play that well, so I missed on someone else. So, but I will not besmirch the name of that fine young man.
No smirching. No smirching. There'll be none of that around here.
I will show how objective I am. My favorite kicker in all of the National Football League, simply because of his accent, South Korean Young Wei Koo, and I'm not talking about a Korean accent. I'm talking about a North Jersey accent.
Yeah.
Why did he kick the ground, and what excuse does he have? What was going on with your Giants kicker?
For a second, I thought you were going to say your favorite kicker in the Mountain West Conference is at Utah State. And for anybody around UNLV, I mean, Utah State's kicker died so UNLV could live. Really is the way it all goes down. But, you know, it's, here we are. For Young Wei Koo, Jersey guy that he is, Steve, let's put it this way. I'm watching the Giants this year for Jackson Dart. Like, I just want to see Jackson Dart. I want to have something to kind of get excited about. And if he tries to kill himself, he tries to kill himself. That's fine. That's not my concern right now. I just want to have some entertainment. And the Giants have done exactly what I want them to do this year. Be entertaining, play some close games, continue to lose because this roster is so fundamentally flawed. So I feel like I have been punched in the gut and kicked in the nards so many times by this team this year. Whether it was the Broncos meltdown, whether it was the Cowboys meltdown, whether it was the Lions meltdown, whether it was the Bears meltdown, I have watched this team give it up in so many different ways. But I found something new. I found Young Wei Koo jamming his foot into the ground on a field goal attempt to the point where Peyton and Eli Manning, who were watching the game with Danny DeVito, said, I've never seen that before. And Danny DeVito even said, what the hell is that? And they're like, I don't know. I've never seen that. And then Young Wei Koo had the gumption, the chutzpah, to say, oh, well, it was a cold day and the ball was moving when the hold went down, so I just couldn't drive through it. I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
You're blaming the holder?
Yeah.
When you're the one who stubbed your foot into the, just swing your leg, buddy. Swing your leg and hope. Swing your leg and get lucky. Because I'll tell you one way you will never make a damn field goal. It is by taking your toe and jamming it into the turf the way that you did. You have done something that even Giants fans who have been living in misery for a decade, you have taken us to a new depth. You have tried to kick below the ground physically, metaphorically, to try to take us to an even lower spot than we have been before. I don't want to hear about how the holder didn't put the ball down just right for you. Kick the ball! Kick the ball.
I got to go to break here in a couple seconds, but I'm very caught up on something you said a minute ago. Wait, Danny DeVito and Eli Manning are hanging out when Eli Manning is stealing his sub deal and wearing bald? I thought Danny DeVito hated Eli Manning. Wait, are these commercials aren't real? I thought they had a real rivalry going.
Now back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Cofield and Company back here on the 5 o'clock hour. As let's get to more of our Raiders talk. And it's been a rough season. Jesse Merrick is with us from Silver and Black Sports Network. I could not believe when I read, thinking back to the beginning of the season, that officially the Las Vegas Raiders have been eliminated from playoff contention. Postseason win drought going back now to 2003. It's pretty crazy. I mean, we've seen the way it's unfolded, but no one thought this was going to happen to Pete Carroll.
No, I mean, look, I think everybody thought, you know, Pete Carroll, the adult in the room, going to come in, lay a foundation. Like, nobody expected them to be, like, a playoff contender or anything like that. I think people thought, like, okay, long shot to make the playoffs, but at least, like, be in the conversation, or at least on the graphics that they show every time on ESPN and NFL Network, you know, come this point of the season. Right. That obviously has backfired in a big way, and sadly, that's kind of been the story for the Raiders. I mean, for quite some time, but especially since they moved here to Vegas, it just seems like no matter which coach or which player or coordinator they bring in, they have like a career worst year. And it's just this perpetual cycle of kind of firing and hiring and firing and hiring. And so no foundation has been able to be built. So it's like one of those deals where you sit back and you wonder, where do they go from here? But definitely a shocking one, you know, again, given Pete Carroll's, you know, history and everything like that. I mean, I think this was that one that, like, I'm not, you know, I'm an optimist, but like, I think most people out there thought like this was going to be the move that at least set that foundation. And then Pete does that in 2 to 3 years. And then they bring somebody in. Maybe that was a Chip Kelly. Maybe it's Patrick Graham. Now you look at it and you're like, man, like, who the heck are they going to bring in? And is this person going to be able to last more than 1 year?
I don't want to be a prisoner of the moment, Jesse Merrick, but this feels as low as any point during downtimes with Gruden, even Josh McDaniel, and with AP. Am I crazy?
No, I don't think you are, because, like, look, in years past, we talked about, like, this a Raiders team not having an identity. So, like, we've been here before having this conversation about, like, what's their identity? But, like, now, I think because people's hopes were so high, that's kind of partially why it feels worse. I mean, last year they went on a 10-game losing streak, and that was tough. Talking with people that cover the team, talking with fans, all of it. This does feel kind of more hopeless right now, which is, again, wild to say. You know, and the big question again is just like, okay, how do they build from here? And that's the question I keep asking is, what can they give fans in the next 5 weeks? Something like that lets them feel better about what's coming their way in the future. You know what I mean? And so it is kind of that like hopeless situation, which makes it tough to sit here and say that. And I hate saying that again, as an optimist, you like to try and point to some things. Yeah. Do they have an Ashton Jeanty, but okay, when are they actually going to be able to get him a line and a play caller and all of those things? And then now too, with the thing that went down with Gino, like, you very likely have to move on from him, as bad as it's been, the flipping off the fans, all of that stuff. So then, okay, who is your quarterback going to be? You're just doing a full reset on so many different parts of this team that I really don't think the optimism really starts to set in till draft time, really, to be completely honest.
Well, let's talk about one of the positives, and that was Brock Bowers. And one of the great catches I think we've ever seen. That was incredible. I don't know what Gino was trying to throw there. I don't know if that was a bad back shoulder attempt or he was trying to throw the ball away. But, you know, you look up and Brock Bowers has a touchdown. It's nuts.
Yeah, I mean, look, we talk about, like, the few things to be, you know, hopeful for. Like, Brock Bowers is obviously one of those things. He is an otherworldly talent for the Raiders. That one was just insane. After the game, you look at him talking in the locker room, and he's like, yeah, I don't really think, I just try and do whatever I can to catch the ball. And it's like, okay, well, how the hell did you think that you even had a shot at that one by throwing your mitt out there for that? Like, just crazy. And again, one of the few bright spots that Raiders fans can take away is that, like, when Brock Bowers is healthy, he is just that dude. No matter whether the ball is on target or not on target, like, he's going to do whatever the heck he can to try and catch that football. One of those things where, like, an insane catch in what was, like, a weekend of just insane catches overall. But that was a fun one, man. And again, one of those few moments where you walk away, you're like, okay, we've got a positive to talk about, because Brock Bowers did something crazy. And it seems like that's the only positive week in and week out.
I thought it was better than Puka. I thought it was better than Burks, because it was unique in the fact that it was on the ground, basically. It wasn't something where you're jumping up with the mitt. The fact that he scooped it, and he did it with the left hand.
Yeah, to have to scoop that one, I mean, that is such a tough catch. Like, I'll be honest, like, I was a receiver, not in the NFL, not at a high level in college, any of that stuff, just, like, in college at a D2 school. So, like, I'm prefacing by saying all of that. But the ones where, like, you're diving back, throwing the hand up as you're going down, like, those are tough, but they're not those like unbelievably tough catches to like throw down and scoop it that close to the ground. Like that's a really hard one because it very easily could like roll up your arm or about just bounce up and get picked. Like that is a much tougher one for me to be able to come down and catch. So like, yeah, I'm with you. I think that was more impressive than the other ones that we saw throughout the weekend, just in terms of pure difficulty while you're falling down in that regard too.
Jesse Merrick, Silver and Black Sports Network here on ESPN Las Vegas. You can follow him at Jesse SVSN on Twitter. Looking at your Twitter account a couple days ago, you had how the offense changed under Greg Olsen, why the results didn't. Did it change, and why didn't the results come through?
Yeah, look, I mean, there was more of a commitment to the run. You know, I guess they still go for it a bit there in that regard. Like, Genty finishes with 15 rushing attempts, which is not a massive change. I mean, look, that's about what Genty has averaged game in, game out, but it just felt like he tried to stick with it a bit more so many times, I think, in this one, and not to give Greg Olsen or the offense as a whole a pass, but like Genty was getting hit 0.2 yards, you know, after he got the ball. So like a guy's right in his face, you know what I mean? So that is one of those games where you're like, look, like they really couldn't run the ball. Like the opportunities just weren't there. Whereas other times I think we saw the run game was working or just the reluctance to run at all. And then they pivot away from it all together and just are like, hey, we're going to throw it. I mean, you can live with 23 pass attempts to 18 rushing attempts. Again, you're probably not going to win many games when that's the case. Like, you can sit back and look at a box score and say, okay, one team ran the ball over 25 times. One team ran the ball 18 times. Who do you think won? You know what I mean? Like, it's pretty easy to play that kind of game there. So I think from that regard, you know, it wasn't a drastic difference, but at least there was a little bit more of an attempt to stay balanced until things kind of started getting out of hand for them. And then I would say in the passing game, I just like the way that he got guys open, you know, particularly Brock Bowers. You know, there were some things where he was doing, you know, some interesting stuff in the play action passing game with a fly sweep play action as well at one point to get Brock open on the sideline. You look down in the red zone, kind of had like a concept where Tyler Lockett is running like a deep in near the goal line to draw the defender up while Brock is behind him running kind of like, you know, along the goal line or a little bit more of a post on that second touchdown, I think it, or first touchdown, I think it was, you know, just in terms of like a game flow and I think play calling in general, much better to me. He tried to get some of the screens going. It's just, you're kind of, and I still said this with Chip Kelly too, like I didn't want to give him a full pass because things needed to change with him. But you're kind of out there fighting with one arm tied behind your back behind this offensive line. I mean, they're just so bad. So, like, they really do, going forward, I think, need to get the quick game going. You know, that's a massive thing. And, again, just, like, have a willingness to stick with the run no matter what the game flow is. Because, like, look, you've won two games. Like, why not just say, hey, we are down, whatever. We're going to run the ball and make you commit to that and then hit you over the top of the play action passing game. Like, that's something I think we need to see more of going forward. But I think it was a small step in the right direction from Greg Olsen back there calling plays, simply from the fact that, like, one, he didn't abandon the run, which is such a low bar to have to say. And two, like, he actually schemed guys open better than I think we had seen throughout most of the season in terms of like complimentary play calling.
Jesse Merrick's with us, Silver Black Sports Network, right here on ESPN Las Vegas. Following you on Twitter, I mean, you can't always get tone off of a written statement, but you almost seem shocked that they were rotating at the guard position with Mafi and Rodgers.
Yeah, I mean, it's what we're 13 weeks in at that point, and you're treating it like a preseason game. That is just that's crazy to me, you know. So like, that's the tone right there. Is that that's just insane, you know? And I'm not the only one that thinks that, you know. Everybody's just like, what the hell are you doing there? And like, I get wanting to get a look at as many guys as possible, and the season's not going well. But to say like they both earned the right to play this far into the season, especially when like offensive line is so much about communication. We've seen communication issues along the offensive line and about guys gelling and being comfortable. Like, you just can't do that when there's so many moving parts. And I get it. There's been injuries. So it's been guys in and out, moving, playing in different positions all the time. You have Alex Kappa at center, but like, why would you willingly rotate through at a position there when you could just be like, hey, like, let's see what the young kid has got to offer to us, which again, could speak more to what he's shown them or more to the coaching staff, just the unwillingness to commit to the young guy, you know? So it's like, that's something we won't know until the off season, you know, come draft time, free agency, whatever, to see how they address those certain positions. But wild to see that. And even to look like at the corner spot, Caillou Bukele, local kid, good kid. We all like him. So I'm not dogging Caillou one, but he's come away with picks, all that stuff. But why are you rotating him and Darian Porter too? Like, that's the other weird thing, because to me, Darian Porter is like the quintessential Pete Carroll pick. he's played well. A lot of times it almost seems like he's gotten beat by really good throws. So, like, why is that kid not getting more opportunities? Is it because Kai's making those plays and coming out with the picks? Okay, cool. Yeah, I totally get that. But, like, why are you rotating every other series or at the bulk that you are this far into the season? Like, you have to get these young guys reps. And I get you can say, oh, well, we're getting more of them reps and more of them, you know, throughout the game. But you're treating these games like practice. And that's just crazy to me because, like, you have to get a look at what those guys are. And I think we, especially for a guy like Darian, who's so young at the position, like, let him get a full, you know, game in there and to be able to, like, get a full game tape on, like, what he does. And also, like, let these guys get in rhythm. But the way they rotated a guard, I don't know that I've seen that before. You know what I mean? Like, purposely from a coaching staff. And that's why it's such a head-scratcher to me in a year that's been full of head-scratchers.
So we heard last week about some weird communication issues with Chip Kelly. Yeah. What did Pete Carroll say about Ole and their communication? Did everything go smoothly?
Yeah, I mean, that's what he made it sound like, you know, in the post-game press conference. You know, he's saying, like, the communication from, you know, the staff to the players was clear, you know, no issues in that regard. And that to me seemed like a, you know, kind of like a, like, let me turn the knife a little bit or a little bit of a jab there at, like, you know, hey, look, we've had issues in the past with the play caller doing that, and now we didn't. You know, so, look, from that regard, like, that's massive, obviously. Like, from Geno's perspective, like, if you're getting, you know, play calls that aren't installed or motions aren't fully tagged in there, like, that's a tough position for anybody to be thrown into. So it sounds like that was better on a short week. And I will say, too, like, think about it with Chip Kelly. Like, the reports out there are that, like, he was being forced to run more of that, like, you know, Shane Waldron-type offense that Pete is more accustomed to. If that's the case, like, I would understand why Pete – or why – Chip Kelly's not exactly getting the full play call in or things like that, because this is a guy that's run the offense that he's running for so long, so it's like second nature, and he's sitting there having to think about somebody else's offense or an offense that isn't quite fully his, you know. And so I can see it in that regard, whereas Greg Olsen has a bit more of a history, you know, with Pete Carroll, this style of system, all those things, even though it is still very much the offense that they had installed, you know, with more of the Chip Kelly like touch on it. It's still at least a little bit more accustomed to what he's doing. So I think from that regard, too, and this is a guy, too, like, let's be real, called plays for a long time in the league, multiple different stops. And so, like, the comfortability, you can definitely see that. And that's a win for this team going forward. So that, again, hopefully they can start to show something to this fan base to kind of build off of.
So I see the leak on something like Chip Kelly, and it drives me nuts because I just, yeah. The Raiders, I think bad organizations are filled with leaks. It's a bad sign. I know you talked to the other media people. I want your opinion as well. This story that comes from Pelissero, who's leaking it? Because immediately yesterday on Cofield and Company, Willie was like, agents. I'm like, well, agents are leaking this? Like, why are there always leaks and it's often Pelissero? Like, what's going on here? Why are they – someone's trying to kill Chip Kelly. Why?
Yeah. More often than not, a lot of the leaks you get, like, player-related are very much so agents. This one, I think with the stuff of people trying to drag Chip through the mud was more so – and this is just my feel for it. I'll be completely honest. I'm not reporting anything. I don't want people to, like, misconstrue what I'm saying here on this. But I would say this is more of, like, a staff thing. Somebody in Pete Carroll's camp trying to push that kind of stuff right there to kind of make it like a, hey, it's not him or it's not us. That was a Chip problem. You know what I mean? And then you hear the thing – I'm talking more so about the initial reports there that came out that like Chip wasn't fully completing those and all that. That's coming from the Pete side of things, I would imagine so, to try and kind of clean up their name. Because this is a guy that, again, seemed like for quite some time was coaching to save his job. Very clearly now seems like that's the case. So trying to make sure it's like, hey, it wasn't us. It was him. And then you hear the other reports, you know, now saying that, like, you know, he's having this forced upon him and everything like that. So that's probably like a battling of the two camps to be like, hey, how do we keep our guy's name the cleanest going forward to give them another opportunity to be able to get back into coaching again? So, yeah, I just think that's weird. It almost seems like, again, you know, squabbling in the public behind, you know, like closed doors to be like, hey, let's leak this and throw that out there. And then it turns into a whole he said, she said thing. And for, you know, the media and other fans and things like that out there, it's just like, hey, it's probably somewhere in the middle. Pete is probably much more involved than he should have been for a coach like Chip Kelly, who's been there, done that at a bunch of different levels. And then also Chip probably not calling the greatest game and all that stuff because he's trying to stick to what he wants to do and is also trying to spit something out that's not necessarily his verbiage. But I would say it's somewhere in the middle there. But again, just speaks to the dysfunction of this team and franchise and kind of where they're at right now, sadly.
By the way, defensively against the Chargers, why did they come unraveled? And did you agree with, I think that one of the TV analysts said they were kind of playing soft?
Yeah. And that's something like Raiders fans know this, like the soft zone coverage is something you've seen a lot from a Patrick Graham defense over the last handful of years. Even with Gus Bradley too, when he was around, it's that whole bend but don't break type of thing. And, you know, oftentimes the Raiders have bent, and then they do break, you know. And I will say, like, I think that they've played better, you know, I think they've played winning football at times defensively throughout the season. It just hasn't been at the clip that it needs to be. And again, they haven't gotten the support from the offense either. So, like, you know, at some point, like, the dam's going to break. But yeah, too often, like, teams are in third manageable situations, and then they're playing that soft coverage, and the team just, like, the opposing team runs to the sticks, and it's like, boom, it's an easy, you know, fall forward for the first down type of thing, you know. And I think a lot of that is, and I had this conversation today when we were taping our podcast, it's going to come out tomorrow, actually, with Cody Alexander from Match Quarters, and he's, you know, a defensive guru, and he basically said, he's like, look, Patrick Graham is hampered by the fact of, like, not trusting his secondary back there. So, like, he can't call as many blitz and be as aggressive as he wants to or as he has in years past because he doesn't have the bodies in the secondary that he trusts back there to, like, lock down and man coverage. Like, look at the game against the Browns. That was, if I remember, I believe that was third down on that 52-yarder that Shador scrambles to the right and hits Isaiah Bond, you know, for one of the bigger plays of the game. I believe that was third down. He blitzes, you know, sends, I think it was, like, seven guys, man up for everybody else, and Darnay Holmes gets beat, you know. And so that's one of those things where, like, he's seen that happen too many times when he's tried to get aggressive and do that. So the adjustment to that is, like, okay, let's play off and make sure they tackle. The only problem is they didn't tackle. I think it was 18 missed tackles in that game against the Chargers. So yeah, too soft. And again, goes back to, like, I've been a big proponent of Patrick Graham as a defensive coordinator. I think he's very underrated. It's probably time for a new voice on that side of the ball as well, though. I think, again, I've come around to the fact that Pete Carroll's probably done after this year, so probably wholesale changes. And, Patrick Graham has been one of the few constants for this Raiders as a defensive play caller. I just think it's probably time for him to go somewhere else, because for his sake and then also for the defense's sake as well, just get a different, a play caller back there that maybe is going to play a little bit tighter in some of those situations and a different philosophy wholesale.
Jesse Marek's up on Cofield & Company from Silver and Black Sports Network. One of the best defensive games the Raiders played all year was about a month ago against the Broncos. They had every chance to win that game. It was on the offense. So let's go back to that game. What do you remember from the game, and how do they kind of turn the corner? Because I think they can limit Bo Nix again, but how do they win it this time?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing, look, like, defensively, like you said, yeah, limit them. Stop the run. Make Bo Nix beat you. That's the recipe right there. And then, you know, offensively, maybe don't give up six sacks, you know, clean it up along the offensive line and figure out a way to get something going. Give Brock Bowers the thing that I walked away with the most from that game was Brock Bowers. I think that was the week after he had went off for 127 yards and three touchdowns against the Jags. If I remember right, 12 catches, you know, targeted a ton, went nuts. Then you go to Denver, a team who has actually struggled against tight ends most of the season. He gets three targets and one catch. I don't give a damn who you're playing, how good the defense is. That cannot happen. You cannot let a defense dictate to you how Brock Bowers is used. That guy is like an otherworldly talent. You got to figure out a way to get him involved. Having said that, defenses are going to circle Brock Bowers, so somebody else has to win. And I think that's where a guy like a Trey Tucker comes in, or Dante Thornton, for instance, at 1.2. You know, they hit him. They've struggled to connect on the deep ball. Geno does throw deep to him at one point in the game, and he just drops it over the shoulder right there. So, like, when those opportunities come about, the young guys have to come through. And that was also a game, now as we're kind of talking it through too, where they shot themselves in the foot a lot offensively too. You know, there was the penalty on Dante Thornton at one point. There was a holding call on Jack Besh, the other young rookie receiver there as well, that brought back a big run by Ashton Jeanty. So, like, it's one of those deals where it's like, one, the Raiders are not good enough to overcome self-inflicted wounds. So keep it clean. Don't commit penalties. And two, offensive line-wise, like, figure out a way to bottle up this rush, because this defense is insane. We've seen the struggles they've had on the offensive line. So, like, get the quick game going and find a way to break through offensively. You know, in a way to take the load off there in terms of, like, pass protecting, is just get the running game going. Much easier said than done, especially with this offensive line. But you got to be able to run the ball to have any sort of shot at an upset here against this team.
What's coming up this week on Silver and Black Sports Network?
Yeah, so as I alluded to, you know, dropping on Wednesday morning at 9 a.m., our conversation with Cody Alexander of MatchQuarters.com. For those of you guys that don't know him, he is a defensive guru. He's literally written six books on defense. I don't know how the hell you even do that, but the guy obviously has a great mind for the game. And so he is a Broncos fan, you know, and so he's really tapped into the Broncos and the AFC West as a whole. So I just kind of wanted his take on, like, one, from a coaching perspective, like, how the Raiders can go about just rebuilding this team as a whole. So we really start to dive into that. And he also gave me my perspective, too, about the stuff with Chip Kelly and whether or not he was running more of that Shane Waldron type offense. Like, teams were saying that the scout teams on the opposing teams were having them run a lot of the Shane Waldron stuff. So I asked him, I was like, hey, what do you think? Like, do you think that's actually true? So he gives me his perspective on that, just in terms of what he saw scheme wise. So just kind of peeling back the curtain a bit. And again, looking ahead to the future of like how the Raiders can start to turn us around and give fans something to look forward to in the future. So again, that's going to be dropping on Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. on YouTube. Make sure you guys check that out.
Last one, Jesse, you played college football, as we talked about like 6 weeks ago, with Spencer Danielson, who's the head coach at Boise. Yeah. First of all, he didn't get coach of the year. Jason Ack at New Mexico got coach of the year. I thought there were a lot of really good coaching jobs. Dan Mullen with 50 plus new players going 10-2 is amazing. But Danielson got them through a tough situation with the quarterback going down. They're back in the title game again. They're hosting it. Can I tell you, you can comment on the job he's done, but can I tell you, part of our conversation was who's going to grab him as a new head coach? I cannot believe that some of the programs in the SEC did not kick the tires on Danielson more. And the other one, I hope it works out for UCLA. I don't get the regional match on a guy who's from Pennsylvania, has coached at Holy Cross and JMU, and how that's going to work in LA when Danielson would have been perfect.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And each time that, you know, the years come around, like, I'm always wondering, like, is this going to be the year? You know what I mean? And, like, I, just as, like, a friend from afar, I stay the hell away from Spence when all that stuff's going on, because I don't even want him to think I'm sitting there prying. But, like, man, I am curious if and when the opportunity comes. And I'm sure some people have kicked the tires. Like, Spence, look, I will say this. He's a very loyal guy. He loves Boise State, and he loves that community. Like, he is – he's essentially Nick Saban up there. You know, like, we've joked before where he's like, man, if I, whatever I eat for breakfast, that could lead the local news. You know what I mean? Like, so, like, it's a, it's one of those places where just football matters so much to that community there. And, you know, it's a place where he does think that there's a path to the playoffs. So it's going to take a lot for him to leave. Having said that, yeah, like you said, UCLA, like, he is a Southern California guy. How the hell do you not kick the tires on someone like him? I understand that, you know, the guy they hired, he's won everywhere he's been, all that stuff. But, like, look at the job Spence has done. And I know some people might say, oh, lesser conference, all that stuff. Well, okay, so is JMU. You know what I mean? And so, like, that's a thing where I'm like, look at what he's done. And like you said, without the quarterback for as long as they did it, you know, in what was considered just such a crazy competitive year in the Mountain West too. So, like, one of those years where they're all beating each other up and he still finds a way to get into that conference championship game. I don't know what it's going to take, to be completely honest. But, like, he's one of those dudes that everyone always talks about that is in the conversation, you know, is one of the best young up and coming coaches, but for whatever reason, it just hasn't materialized into an actual job offer that I know of. So I'm real curious to see where he goes, but man, I guess you go, you win the conference championship and then do whatever you're going to do in the pack, whatever the hell they call it going forward. You know, maybe win a couple championships there, and then maybe somebody will come calling. But I can't wait for that opportunity to happen, because I know it's only a matter of time. And I know when he gets there, he's going to build one hell of a program wherever he does end up at the big-time school.
Jesse, good job. Enjoy the Raiders game this week. Enjoy the rest of the season.
Yeah, I'll try. Sometimes
trying to find stories.
Thanks again, man.
There he is, Jesse Marek. Thanks to all of our guests today. John Cecenti joining us in hour number one, talking Las Vegas Bowl. That was awesome. Adam Candy co-hosting here on a Tuesday, Cofield and Company. We're back tomorrow. Battleborn Injury Lawyers will be the site. Justin Watkins is in. Pros versus Joes with Alex White as well. That'll do it on a Tuesday night for Cofield and Company. Make sure you follow the show, as we have the show live on social media. Look up Cofield and Company for videos on YouTube. We're up on TikTok and Twitter and Facebook. We'll see you on Wednesday on ESPN Las Vegas.